Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
They smiled and they said, China has changed. And they said, you know, we are pragmatic people. We don't know how to do the sort of movie you do. Therefore, we think you're the right person. And we need you.
French filmmaker Jean-Jacques Annaud's 1997 film, 7 Years in Tibet, was banned in China, and he was told to stay out, too. Years later, Chinese producers came to Annaud with a request to make a movie in China. Wolf Totem is now China's Oscar submission for Best Foreign Language Film. Annaud tells us what changed, what you need to know to make a hit in China, and how he managed a whole lot of wolves. But first on the News Banter, Colbert is back, and awards season is underway. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my banter buddy, Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Kim.
As we are speaking, Telluride is over and Toronto is getting underway. So awards season, it's just going to be 6 months.
Can't we get through television award season first, Kim? Let's
no,
get through
we
the
cannot.
Emmys.
Not yet. We will get to the Emmys in about a week or so.
Okay.
So, you know, this Telluride seems to have been fairly well stuffed with movies that are perceived as being in Oscar contention. We can just talk a little bit about a few. I'd say, based on the people I've talked to who were there, who watched a lot of these movies, Black Mass, and this is the Whitey Bulger story, starring Johnny Depp, an almost unrecognizable Johnny Depp as this mobster, seems to be by consensus the movie that people are really liking. I mean, I'm hearing so much about a great performance in this movie or a great performance in that movie, but Black Mass, they're actually talking not just about Johnny Depp, but the movie.
Yeah. Well, Johnny Depp, by the way, I mean, it's nice to hear Johnny Depp back to form. And after several disappointments, this is Johnny Depp as we love to see him, really embodying a character.
Yeah, I mean, it already looks like we're going to see a lot of competition, certainly in Best Actor. You had Michael Fassbender in Steve Jobs. You know, this is a movie directed by Danny Boyle, who's certainly been, you know, won his Oscar previously and is a very well-regarded director. It bounced from Sony to Universal. It was originally going to be a David Fincher movie with Christian Bale, and now it turned out to be a Danny Boyle movie with Michael Fassbender. But Aaron Sorkin,
yeah,
rat-a-tat-tat.
I was going to say, a script by Aaron Sorkin, and again, sounds like perfect classic Aaron Sorkin with that rat-a-tat-tat dialogue, as you mentioned, and that's very exciting to look forward to as well.
Yeah, people are very interested in the film, although I'd say in terms of pure like, Black Mass seemed to be liked better, whatever that's worth. You know, you're going to see Eddie Redmayne will be back in The Danish Girl playing this transgendered person, a historic fact-based story. So there will be competition among the guys.
Yeah, and on the actress side, you know, some names that we're hearing a lot about is Brie Larson in Room, who it sounds like really impressed.
Yeah, people definitely talking about her. This is based on the book about a woman who was kidnapped and imprisoned for many years by one of those crazy people who does that sort of thing. And she has a child while in captivity, and definitely her performance has been talked about, as has Cate Blanchett in Carol, which is a lesbian love story, and people are talking a lot about that one, too. Suffragette is another movie that people are interested in on the female side. So, you know, plenty to chew over.
Now, on the documentary side, a film that who knows if it'll be a contender, because who knows if we'll ever
actually be able to see it.
It depends on what Aretha Franklin is feeling, but obviously Amazing Grace, the 40 years in the making documentary that everyone's been chomping at the bit to see, apparently we're going to have to wait a little longer to see.
Maybe a lot longer. It didn't get shown at Telluride. Very unusual. She got an injunction preventing the film from being shown. That's not a common thing, but she said she had not given permission for this. This is something shot by the late Sidney Pollack and long aborning, and it's now not going to show at Toronto.
Yeah, and a lot of big questions about whether or not that was prior restraint and the judge's motivations in allowing her to shut this down. You know, we'll see what happens next there.
Turning to a different kind of competition, late night, Stephen Colbert is back this past week. Huge first night and a little rough going on the second.
Yeah, he opened well, about 6 million viewers, not as well as Jimmy Fallon did last year, and also not quite as well as some other recent launches, but it was still strong enough to win the night. Now, night two, things settled back, and Jimmy Fallon once again won that second night of competition, and that looks to be probably where things will settle out going forward. The Tonight Show starring Jimmy Fallon's just been such a monster over the past year. He's really redefined late night, turned it into a true variety show where it's not so much about the guests, it's more about the song and dance routines and him playing along with the guests. And so it's going to be interesting to see what Colbert does to counterbalance that.
Yeah, I think probably, looking analogizing it to Leno versus Letterman, it feels like if Stephen Colbert can just find his legs in this new environment, that Fallon is younger, funner, and hopefully, from my point of view, Colbert becomes a little bit more edge and Letterman-like in that, catering to an older audience, but maybe a slightly more intellectual take.
Right. What I hope is that Colbert turns into the smarter, sophisticated alternative. What I worry is that if the ratings go down, they're not going to allow him to do that. I love Colbert's bookings right now. He's booking authors. He's booking politicians. Elon Musk was on the second night. So, he has the potential to have a really smart, interesting group of guests. But like I mentioned before, these shows really aren't about guests anymore. So, hopefully he'll find his legs in the coming weeks.
Meanwhile, hearkening back to, an awards contender that we haven't talked about in a couple of years, Zero Dark Thirty, Vice just came out with a big report on the filmmakers, the director, Kathryn Bigelow, the screenwriter, and one of the producers, Mark Boal. That movie was immediately mired in controversy over its hints or implications that torture was important in locating Osama bin Laden. And there's a question always, did Boal and Bigelow somehow infiltrate the CIA and find out all kinds of secrets, or did the CIA somewhat seduce Boal and Bigelow and sell them on the CIA narrative? But certainly this Vice piece suggests that the Zero Dark Thirty filmmakers got in there in ways that were not okay at the CIA, and the CIA is now going to have, there have been several internal investigations, and they're changing their policies vis-a-vis Hollywood.
Right. A lot of this information Vice actually found out via a Freedom of Information Act. And some of the things that both Boal and Bigelow passed out to CIA agents and members, pretty interesting. Bigelow apparently met with one officer and offered a pair of Tahitian pearl earrings. There were hotel lunches. There was ticket to a Prada runway show. There was high-priced tequila.
High-priced tequila, yeah.
100-something
bucks a bottle, yeah. I mean, some of these things like lunches may not sound like that big of a deal, but when you work for the government, these things are different. And when you work for the CIA, I would imagine they're somewhat extra different. And and Mark Boal was in a ceremony which was attended by then CIA Director Leon Panetta, and he gave a classified speech, Panetta, and it wasn't clear who knew that Boal was even there and whether Panetta knew. This was a can of worms, and if you want to make a movie now, I think involving the CIA, you might find that that bar has been jacked up a bunch of notches.
All right, or you better buy some even more expensive tequila.
Yeah, I still do wonder, who seduced who here. That's the real mystery.
Mutual seduction.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Kim.
That's Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine. Oscar-winning director Jean-Jacques Annaud has made movies around the world, from The Name of the Rose in Italy to Two Brothers in Cambodia. One place he did not expect to work is China. His 1997 film, 7 Years in Tibet, filmed mostly in Argentina, upset the Chinese government, and both Annaud and star Brad Pitt were banned from entering the country. No one then was more surprised than Annaud to get a visit from Chinese producers in 2007, asking him to make a very Chinese movie. They wanted Annaud to adopt the bestseller Wolf Totem, a semi-autobiographical novel about a student from Beijing sent to live in Inner Mongolia during the 1967 Cultural Revolution. The book is critical of Mao's communist regime, especially the damage caused by urban settlers who upset the delicate balance in the region between humans and wolves. Obviously, the project meant working with wolves. Annaud had worked with animals before, and he was up for the challenge. But still, he wondered, had the Chinese government really gotten over its very negative reaction to 7 Years in Tibet?
I was sorry that I upset people because that was not my intention. You know, I'm not a confrontational person. On the contrary, I wish that 7 years in Tibet will allow everyone to understand each other better. And of course, you know, when the people came to me, to my office in Paris, and asked me if I'd read Wolf Totem, the book, I said yes. And when I said how much I respected and enjoyed that wonderful book. But I reminded them that I had upset the nation.
You reminded them?
Yes,
had they forgotten?
No, they smiled and they said, China has changed. And they said, you know, we are pragmatic people. We don't know how to do the sort of movie you do. Therefore, we think you're the right person. And we need you. The simplicity of their speech was such that I trusted them. I've been left entirely free. I've always been a Final Cut director.
Right.
But you will normally, and it's quite natural, get a sort of friendly pressure, let's call it this way.
Right.
No, I didn't even have that.
So they come to you and you say, well, I just want to mention... this thing that happened, and they're like, yeah, never mind. And
yes.
Like one of those families where there's a fight and then you pretend there was never a fight.
Yes, and you know what it does? When you start with a row, when you spit out your anger, it happened to me many times in life with people that I was angry with, and then they became my best friend. Because we started that way. And I cannot help but thinking of my dear, dear friend James Horner. You know, he did the music for one of my early movies, The Name of the Rose. We loved each other for like 15 days. And after 15 days, I couldn't stand this electronic music. I didn't understand. And we got upset with each other. And over the years, we became extraordinarily close friends, possibly because we had yelled at each other.
Right. And then, of course, you lost him.
Yes, that was a big...
You actually lost two key people on this film, right? You had a co-writer who...
Yes, my co-writer for many, many years didn't finish the screenplay, let's put it this way. And James, I was so close to
James. Just a few months ago, just maybe 2 or 3 months ago.
Last time I came to Los Angeles was to do the spotting of the music. I spent several marvelous days with him. I love this character. He's been the first person to see my movie, you know, before any official saw this movie. James was the first person to react and was like a brother and one of my closest friends.
So there was so much with this movie. And one of the reasons I understand that they came to you, it's a very Chinese story. It's a beloved Chinese novel. China being China would have certainly gone to a Chinese director, but nobody seemed to want to work with the wolves.
Well, all those great, wonderful Chinese directors became my friends now. They didn't feel that they would want to spend so much time in Mongolia with difficult animals like wolves, you know.
Right.
There's something in China that people like to churn movies after movies. And, you know, there's a lot of excitement right now because there opens 18, 20 screens a day.
Right.
Therefore, there's a lot of money flooding in. And most of the movie are either martial art movies or romantic comedies. It's things that you can do quickly. A lot of CGI or a lot of quick shoot in a city. And frankly, this is not my style. But I do understand that they... you know, felt, and also there is a political content in this movie.
There's an implied criticism of the government, of the...
They were frightened. They were worried. They said to me that. They didn't think that it was going to be an easy ride, that there would be interference from the official, while my experience was just the opposite. They apparently just wanted a neutral voice.
So you come there, and I mean, I actually wanted to ask you, because as you undoubtedly know, so many American former executives or producers have made this trek to China looking for the gold. They want the money. And China has been the first, you know, we've watched a lot of outsiders, the Japanese, the Germans, they come here and there tends to be a bit of a fleecing that goes on of the outside investors. But the Chinese have not been so easy for Hollywood.
Well, you know, they've learned about this silly, it started with silly Arab money. When I first came here to have Quest for Fire produced by 20th Century Fox, I remember people were talking about silly Arab money. And after that came the French, silly French money. And then came the Japanese, and then came the German. And the Chinese, they had time to learn. And what made me laugh is when I started this movie in 2009 and started building compounds for the wolves and training the wolves, a lot of my friends from Europe, from France or from America would say, Che, what are you doing? What are you doing? A movie in China?
Well, and then all
and
of
now
a sudden,
they're all calling me. They say, tell me, your contact at Wanda, your contact at Soho, your contact at Alibaba, can you help us? It's funny, you know, to see, like in the Shanghai Film Festival, Beijing Film Festival, there was no one going five years ago. Now there is a long line around the block.
They can't get there
yeah,
fast
and,
enough.
And they all, you know, what's also amusing is they don't say we have a film to do, or they don't say we want to do a movie. No, they say we have a franchise with Chinese content.
Mm-hmm.
It's a new world. But you know, what you have to keep in mind is in China they produce 600 films a year, 400 get a release, and only 34 foreign movies are
The quota.
Authorized. Mm-hmm. And of course, they are only blockbusters, because this is sure money.
So, I mean, the thing I always hear when these guys come back empty-handed from China is that they've been told yes when it really meant no.
Yeah, of course.
This is the
Asian politeness.
And that you never know who you're dealing with. That you think it's this guy, but it's really that guy. And given all of that, can the American industry crack China, or is China going to crack Hollywood?
Well, you know what? I feel that you can have a very positive experience if it's for genuine reasons. If you have an American-Chinese story, if everyone involved is genuine, if it's not just to get
the
bucket of gold,
yeah,
you can have a very positive adventure. If you go there with the mentality of a pirate, just wanting to steal the money, people are not silly. They won't go for it because they understand the intentions. And that's one thing that's very important in China. People look at the heart instead of just the, hey, you're great. No. They want to make sure that you are here for the right reason. And of course, people most of the time are not here for the right reason. I've been saying that to my French colleagues, saying, don't even go, don't touch. You'll be disappointed. You'll be miserable. You're going to be yelled at. You're going to lose your time.
Right. So in your case, you've been involved with this, as you said, for years. You turned down Life of Pi for this movie, right?
Yeah, well, but, you know, I love the novel Life of Pi. I love the producer here. And at the same time, I was offered Wolf Totem. And frankly, the two books don't have the same significance. Life of Pi is a wonderful fable. Wolf Totem is more than a movie. It has a resonance in terms of conservation, nature,
environmental stuff,
which is so important in China. As we know, you know, without America and China backing a change, a real change of our behavior, we're not going to survive on this planet. So this is why I was so touched, because I felt that I was given the opportunity to have a voice. It's like a one drop of water in a bucket. But I felt it was important. This novel was important in China. When people discovered it, they said, yes, this is our problem. We don't respect nature enough. We love nature. You know, Chinese culture is about nature. I mean, ancient Chinese culture. And recently, there was so much thrill about, you know, getting to be the manufacturer of the world, to build those factories and have work and earn money. And then suddenly people realize that it has a cost and they have to do something about it. And to be asked to give my voice to this was a great honor.
Coming up after a short break, Jean-Jacques Annaud tells us why he insisted on using real Mongolian wolves in his film. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
We'll be right back. Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to filmmaker Jean-Jacques Annaud about his new movie, Wolf Totem, which is China's Oscar submission this year for Best Foreign Language Film. Shot largely in very remote Inner Mongolia, Wolf Totem took 7 years to make. Annaud wanted to use real native wolves, who don't take direction too well, so the production had to raise and train animals, especially for the project. These are intimidating creatures, though they look quite different from the gray wolves of North America.
The Mongol wolves are like the color of lions, and they have the eyes of tigers, green or hazelnut. They're very different even in their behavior because they are grassland wolves. They are not forest wolves. Therefore, their strategy, their thinking is different. So this is why we went through the great difficulty of training them from the age of 4 weeks. And we had three generations on screen. You know, we have the adults. We had to wait 3.5 years for them to become adults, and then we had the teenagers, and then we had the babies.
So the budget.
Well, listen, you know, the movie is a French-Chinese co-production, 80% Chinese. The rest, 20%, is has been raised with different countries in Europe. The budget officially is $40 million. It looks like more on screen because...
It definitely does. And I would say when I was reading, I kept seeing different numbers. It kept going all over the place.
It's why I don't really know, because... What I can say is I had everything I wanted. They wanted to please me. It's very bizarre. It's very strange what I'm telling you. Even myself, when I'm listening to me, I'm saying, would what? I trust this guy?
Yes, I'm trying to give you a skeptical look here.
You're right, because it's a very unusual, very rare thing. You know, they bought new cameras for me. They rebuilt an entire soundstage. They definitely want to improve the quality. And they very nicely said, well, you know, don't be afraid to ask what you need to make the sort of movie you do usually. We don't want you to do something that would not be close to your heart, so just ask us. And I did.
I suppose they might have looked upon it as something of a learning exercise combined with making a movie. They said that to me. Yeah.
And it was very touching. And, I had a very loving crew. At the beginning, they were a bit destabilized because my ways were not their ways. But after a while, it's one of the best crew I ever had.
What language was used on set?
The language I'm using here, ou français, je vais parler français. But you see, I had to deal with three communities. I had to deal with the Mandarin-speaking Chinese, Han Chinese. I had to deal with the Mongols. All the people playing Mongols are Mongol actors. And I had to deal with wolves. So, there are very few people in the world who speak the three languages. And I decided we had a lot of interpreters, but they were very all committed to the movie, and each department had interpreters.
Did either you attempt from, Chinese at all?
Yeah, I know to say Zoiga, which means à la vôtre in French, to your health, and drink it all. This is the only thing I learned.
Okay, well, that's important.
It's vital. You know, the private relationship at dinner is very important.
The wolves in the film, certainly, you know, one of the points of your film is that the wolves are wild and there's no taming the wolves. And I don't know how tame you felt your wolves were.
They're never tame. You know, my remarkable trainer, Andrew Simpson, is an Englishman living in Canada. And his wife decided to live for 3 years in Beijing. And they always... said to me, never trust. I'll give you an anecdote. One of the trainer who fed those wolves, bottle-fed the wolves as babies, a year and a half later, he comes like every morning with buckets of meat for the wolves. But this day is tripped in a marmot hole and he's limping.
Uh-oh.
Well, he had to led the two buckets where they were and went run against the fence and yelled for help.
Because they see him as vulnerable.
He became meat.
Yeah, quarry.
Himself. Mm-hmm. So, I had a very friendly relationship with the alpha male, with the king. Very humble, became my friend, was licking me every morning. It was almost, embarrassing because it was long. It was for 10 minutes of lovemaking, of passionate kisses. He was especially in love with my left ear and also would pull my cheek, my nose. But, I just knew that maybe one day he'd change his mind. And after all, the meat inside my ear would be
delicious,
more important than the affection he had for me. And we took great precaution.
Well, actually, I was going to read to you a quote from you, which I thought was very perfect. You were talking about the wolves, I think, and you said, "It's the same in Cannes." "It's a cruel and fragile world of ambition where your fate can be decided in a few seconds. You get thousands of lickings and then you lose a leg." And then you said, "If my movie gets a bad review, my friends are very happy and they're still my friends." That this is human.
I didn't remember I was saying that, but yes, I believe that. I remember one day I saw my friend, the alpha male, lost his position to his brother. So his brother became the king. What was extraordinary was the sudden licking the ass. Not illusion, physically, the whole pack of wolves. They were dubious because they know that their new king was not that smart. But he was, he won the election, right? and my friend, the king, didn't want to lose his leg or his eye, so he decided to let his brother. After all, he kept his leading role and he kept his wife, which was apparently essential to him. Then when I saw the pack behaving like buffoons and licking the ass of the new king, I thought that I was at the Élysée Palace. I remember saying to myself, I've seen that scene before.
I know this movie.
Yes.
I've seen this. So it opened earlier this year in China. And it's a hit in China, right? It's a big hit.
We are among the all-time box office success. I think we're number 22 all-time box office success. It's, major, major hit, which was unexpected because, this is not the usual Chinese movie. And my friends over there, they said, don't worry, it may not do well at the box office because this is not something that the Chinese like to see. Well, they were proven wrong because we opened with packed houses and we increased our numbers day by day.
Of course, it was a very popular novel.
It was a popular novel, but it's different. The people who go to cinema initially are not the readers.
Right, not necessarily the readers.
As we know, it's not because you make a famous book among intellectuals that you will have a crowd lining up in front of the multiplex.
Well, do you have any particular hopes for how it will perform in the United States?
Well, I do know. I lived here. So I know that selling a Chinese story to an American audience is a difficult task. But I had a movie, my first movie called Black and White in Color with the Academy Award, and I managed to have a reasonable amount of viewers.
It did okay.
It did well.
Yeah.
Yes. So, my view is that I know there is an appetite from many people to see something else. A lot of people I know are discouraged, even the people who do those movies are discouraged by the offer. So this is definitely a different offer. And it's like I often compare it to those streets where you have all kind of restaurants that are serving the same kind of food. Here, it's a different experience.
Jean-Jacques Annaud is the director of Wolf Totem. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for inviting.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.